This meeting of the Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We are one short of a quorum, but we will have that in a minute, I believe. We are going to meet until 1:30, and in addition to these, we have some other bills to hear this afternoon whenever we come back at 4 o'clock, I believe. But we're going to try and get through this list this time if we're able to do so. Senator Bach, welcome to the committee, Senate File 1008.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a delete all amendment. This is the first committee to get it into. It gets it into the same condition it's in over on the House side.
Sure. Senator Osmick?
Yeah.
Moves A1 amendment to put the shape in the bill that the author wants. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1008 is a bill that was brought to me by the wood products industry in northern Minnesota. When the state sells timber sales at public auction, we're proposing a couple of changes here in the delete all that the department has agreed to. One is the interest rate that gets charged, that the commissioner has authority to charge. Currently, there's permissive language that the commissioner can charge 8% if the sale's not cut during the time that was in the award of the sale. Changes that down to 5, and it's still just permissive language. And the other is the down payment. When parcels of wood are bid up over the appraised price from $5,000 to $10,000 of appraised value. There's no fiscal note to the bill. I would like to have Mr. Scott Dane from the Associate Contract Loggers maybe speak to it. He's the one that brought the bill to us.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Dane. I'm the Executive Director of the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers of Minnesota. And the timber industry has been struggling since the housing collapse in 2006 began, and the cash flow has been seriously impacted by this downturn. The Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers did a survey analysis of how much money is held currently by county and other public land programs, and we were surprised to learn that $7 million is held out of circulation on the books for a 1 to 5 year period. What we wanted to find out was how much money was out there, because that might be an opportunity for us to adjust that and allow for a more cash flow for this industry as we struggle through. And that's why we identified the bid premium or bid guarantee, and we were surprised to learn that the Minnesota DNR actually has on the books almost $1.4 million under the bid guarantee, and that's what Senator Bach had mentioned, changing the parameters for that bid guarantee from a $5,000 increase above appraised value to $10,000, and we fully support that. And the other thing we found out was the timber extension policy does require an 8% penalty, if you will, on top of the value of the contract. Lowering that down to 5% would impose less of a penalty. The point being, and we've talked to the DNR and worked with them on this, is loggers don't make money when they have a contract, a timber contract. They only make money when they harvest that and sell that wood. So it's not to any logger's advantage to sit on a timber contract and not harvest it. But sometimes circumstances dictate they need an extension, otherwise they forfeit their entire security. So based on those two changes that Senator Bach has proposed, the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers strongly supports those changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dane. Before we take testimony from Mr. Brandt, Senator Osmick renews the motion that we adopt the author's amendment A1. We didn't have a quorum present last time. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. Questions from the committee for Mr. Dane? Otherwise, Mr. Brandt, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Wayne Brandt, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. We, too, support this bill as brought forward by Senator Bach and the department. We think it's will be an important change, streamline things, lessen paperwork on the department. As for the interest rate, I would just note for the committee, it's always seemed a little odd to pay interest on wood to which we don't hold title. The state holds title to the wood until it's harvested and paid for. So, you know, we do, as Mr. Dane said, strongly support wood when sold, getting harvested, getting to the mills, and moving on so the folks can get their payments made. And so the work that's being done and needs to be done in the forest and the DNR's plans can get done. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Questions from the committee? Is there anybody who wished to speak with concerns about the legislation? If not, Senator Osmick moves Senate File 1008 be recommend as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there any discussion of that motion? Any last comment, Senator Bach?
No, Mr. Chairman.
If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to take up Senator Tomasoni's bill before Senator Hurd's bill. Senate File 1460. Welcome to the committee, Senator
Thomas Sooney. Thank you for adjusting your schedule, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. Mr. Chairman and committee members, Senate File 1460 is related to state lands on meandering lakes and being withdrawn from sales. And we just amended it to exclude school trust lands from the prohibition of sales on state lands bordering on or adjacent to meandering lakes and other public waters and water courses with live timber growing on them. The University of Minnesota desires that the university lands, which are commonly known as puff lands, also be exempted from the prohibition of sale on this type of state lands. Approval of this proposed bill would provide an additional exemption and would allow the Department of Natural Resources, when appropriate, to sell additional puff lands. This bill would eliminate the need to seek legislative approval when there is a parcel of university trust land bordering public waters that is identified for sale, and proceeds from the sale of these lands can only go to the permanent university fund, which supports an endowed chair account. And with that, I'll let the university comment on that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm Susan Carlson-Weinberg, Director of Real Estate for the University of Minnesota. And I would like to add that the purpose of the university, or the permanent university fund, is to create funds to support the university. We welcome the conversion of the puff lands to cash when appropriate to fund the permanent university fund. And we trust that the DNR will determine when it is appropriate for puff lands to be sold and recognize that that there may be an appropriate time to do so. So this amendment would provide that flexibility, and we would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions for Ms. Carlson-Weinberg? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tomasoni, would you require a 50-foot buffer on these lands?
I think she was being facetious, but I'm not sure. Mr. Chair. No, I have no clue about the buffer.
Is there further questions from the committee? If not, Senator Hoffman moves Senate File 1460. He recommended to pass and referred to the Higher Ed Finance Division?
Yes.
Finance Committee?
Yeah, I think so, Mr. Chairman, yes.
On that motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Senator Eaton's point, I do have a 50-foot marker outside my door if anybody wants to know how big that actually is.
That's what I was referring to.
I heard you stretched a tape measure.
Yes,
in there.
Yes, we did do that. So. Thank you.
Let me stand on it one day.
I'm way too fast here today.
Senator Hurd, the Omnibus Lands Bill. And Senator Hurd moves the subcommittee report, which should be in our packets. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Welcome to the committee. We got the subcommittee report in front of us.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committees. Senate File 1406 is a 2015 omnibus land bill. This bill contains provision that authorizes sale of state parcel and transfer of tax forfeited lands. It includes three parcels proposed by the DNR, as well as provision authorizes the county to sell or convey lands. And our land subcommittee listened to a total of 12 bills and cover that covers land parcel in 16 counties. Every bill is very, very, very straightforward and has strong support from witnesses and the DNR and passed with unanimous decision. I'd like to thank my fellow subcommittee members, Senator Scalzi, Senator Weber, and Senator Cohen for the full quorum from start to finish, and spend late night hours, you know, listening carefully to all this bill, and really appreciate them for their hard work. And we spent about an hour and a half, I suppose, listening to a total of 12 bills. And so I ask for your support, members, on this omnibus bill after I make a motion to amend, to add on the Senate file 657. Yep.
Okay. The Thomasoni bill, which was in our packets, you had told us about this as well. Did you or Ms. Lewis want to speak to the amendments? Or?
Yes, Ms. Lewis can speak to the amendments.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director, Lands and Minerals, DNR. This particular bill, Senate File 657, concerns a lakeshore lot in St. Louis County. In 2012, the legislature authorized the county to go through a process to sell its leased lakeshore lots. As the county is working on the parcels, they identified that one of the properties actually was county fee land that was connected with the tax forfeited land, and there's part of a cabin on it. And so they wanted to be able to add that cabin and that property together to offer in that leased sale process. So it's only really particularly one site that they're addressing. And DNR has reviewed it and has no concerns.
Okay. Is there anybody who wished to speak with concerns about this amendment? Now, are there any questions from the committee? If not, on Senator Herr's motion to add the language of Senate File 657 into the Omnibus Lands Bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Ms. Lewis, did you want to comment any more about any of the other provisions in the bill? I know you've gone through it all in the Lands Committee, but any other comments you want to make?
Mr. Chair, it's a non-controversial bill this year. All the particular tax forfeit parcels have been reviewed by Department of Natural Resources staff. If there were any particular concerns, we worked with the counties and they made adjustments in the language, and they've been included in the bills that were introduced and are before you now. And so we are have no concerns about any parcels in the bill.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lewis, is there a definition for surplus state land?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there is not an explicit definition in state statute. What we look at is when we identify surplus state land, it's no longer needed for natural resource purposes when we're looking at it for the Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen, did you have?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say thank you to Mr. Senator Herr and Ms. Lewis, because I've never gone through one of these, and my land is in here, and so felt like I came to the committee unprepared. And they took care of me. So
it is a good process, I think, there. So thanks to the subcommittee members for their work.
And Senator Rosen, you did very well.
Is there any further discussion on this bill? If not, Senator Herr moves that. Does this bill go anywhere? This goes to the floor. Senator Herr moves it. Senate File 1406, as amended, be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And I'm going to suggest if we keep moving this fast, we may move up the other two bills and not have an afternoon meeting. Late afternoon. This is.
Thank you, members.
I don't know if we're doing that, but maybe if you can get the other bills ready, it would be good. Senator Sparks, is he here? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 877 is an attempt to address costs charged to utilities wanting to cross under railroads. As our utilities and telecommunication providers are trying to deploy services across the state, it's sometimes necessary to cross rail lines. When doing so, they have faced large fees from the railroads that have little real-world ties to the costs associated with the projects and the impact on their business. I know, Mr. Chair, you have a busy schedule, so I will turn over to my testifiers for explanation and to answer any questions you have. With me today, I have Brent Christensen with the Minnesota Telecom Alliance and Joel Johnson with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association.
Mr. Christensen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I am with the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. We're a trade association that represents 42 independent telecommunications carriers in Minnesota. The MTA members and many other utilities, such as the members of the MREA, support this bill. The problem this bill addresses is the ransom level of fees that railroads charge utilities, like telecom companies, for installing fiber optic cable at a minimum of 5 feet below railroad tracks. This problem has gotten so bad that states like Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota have passed laws establishing reasonable fees for these crossings. This bill is modeled almost word for word after a law South Dakota enacted last year. While addressing the reasonable safety and insurance concerns of the railroad, this legislation, like that in South Dakota, seeks a $750 crossing fee. As background, you should know that without charge, upon receipt of a permit, utilities bury facilities like fiber optics for thousands of miles along state, county, and township roads throughout Minnesota. For these thousands of miles, there's no charge until the road crosses a railroad track. When this occurs, the railroads demand a ransom level of fees for the privilege of the telco directionally boring a conduit 5 or more feet below the tracks. To be clear, these borings generally begin and end on highway rights-of-way and never intrude upon the surface of railroad property. Minnesota law states that the value of these crossings is to be measured by the diminution of value of fiber cable 6 feet or 5 or more feet below the surface imposes on the railroad. Instead of a nominal fee based on the law, the diminution of value, the railroads seek a charge of $5,000, $10,000, and up to $40,000 a crossing, and the fee is only for a fixed period, 10 to 15 years, after which another fee is due. A Brainerd Telco Cooperative, CTC, testified at a previous hearing that they have plans to install fiber optic surface to the city of Randall in 2015. They have many unavoidable rail crossings in the city, and based on recent experience, without this bill, they expect railroads will insist on over $80,000 in crossing fees. These funds that would otherwise go to providing more broadband to more customers. Another telco, Garden Valley Cooperative, has had a nightmare trying to upgrade service, a fiber line, to the Fauston City Hall. Because the Fauston City Hall is surrounded by railroad property, Garden Valley must seek a permit from the railroad to directionally bore a fiber line that begins on private property, tunnels beneath the railroad property, surfacing at City Hall. The railroad must has just informed Garden Valley that the charge to get them only halfway to City Hall is about $21,000. A permit for a similar length will be also required for a total cost of over $40,000. Another abuse this bill addresses is the right of the utility to choose its insurer rather being forced to use the railroad insurer. Telcos have reported that insurance from the railroad insurers has also required exorbitant rates. For less than 1 day of construction, the average period of coverage, premiums have been over $4,000. MTA members across the state are constantly installing fiber and upgrading, expanding, and replacing facilities to meet customer demands for ever more broadband capacity across Minnesota. This bill will fairly treat and compensate railroad for the legitimate concerns, as did South Dakota, while diverting their ransom level crossing fees to more and expanded broadband deployment. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joel Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. We, too, support this bill and would like to thank Senator Sparks for authoring it. I won't go into many of the same details, but we've experienced kind of the same ransom process when we're trying to apply for crossings from the railroads. There has been unofficial agreement over a decade that the standard typical fee would cost $750. Unfortunately, the land companies that manage the land for the railroads are constantly trying to add additional fees to expedite the process or just simply ignore what the agreement is and push up the price. The worst example is one crossing in Senator Sparks' district outside of Albert Lee. The land company said the charge would be $40,000. Same crossing a mile away a year before cost the utility $1,500. There really isn't any rhyme or reason. We do have a process by which we can go before the Department of Commerce and have them set a fair fee based on the diminution of value. And every time that we do mention to the railroads that we are going to take in this process, which is time-consuming, it means, you know, co-ops from have to travel down to St. Paul, make their case before the Department of Commerce, be assessed for that process. The railroads will back off because they know that the fee would be less than the $750 that we're asking. So we're just asking this to be set into place so that we don't have to jump through these hoops time and time again every time we try to cross a railroad line. Thank you, and I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Sparks or the testifiers, are the railroads indicating the cost or the reason for the cost or the high cost on these fees and the insurance is because some perceived risk as far as derailments or some type of activity that would cause them to need that money, or are they just doing it for the fun of gouging, in your opinion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmond, some representatives of the railroad testified in the last committee stop that we had that they needed these fees to for mapping purposes and for registering, and I can't remember all the things that they said, but it's by law it's supposed to be just for the diminished use of their facilities, and when we bore underneath them, there isn't any.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Sparks, telecom is in your committee's jurisdiction, so I assume either you saw the bill, at least. You as author, I mean, saw the bill, I guess.
No, I believe it started in transportation, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Okay, I just wondered about telecom. And the fact that these are the only witnesses, I will ask, is there anybody else who wishes to testify about the bill? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul, here to testify in opposition to the bill. As was mentioned, there has been a deal in place for about 20 years dealing with electric cooperatives in the state of Minnesota, where BNSF charges $750 for a single, simple direct crossing going over our property. Our standard is $1,500 for municipalities and utilities, and then it's a higher fee for other types of crossings. $750 typically would not cover the cost of processing an application. We have an outside company that charges us to process these applications. We have to have a legal review of documents. We have to have people determine proof of insurance and so on. We have to have an engineering review. We have to have our local engineering people determine if the site is proper. We have to record these crossings in all of our maps and documents. So, yes, there is a cost to the company for doing it. If there is a higher cost, I don't know the particulars of the crossings that were discussed earlier, if those were direct crossings involving something like a high-pressure natural gas line, if it was an electric transmission line of some sort, or if it was a parallel use of the property, which we would charge a higher price for. Bear in mind that these crossings are not of any benefit to the railroad. In fact, they pose a liability exposure to the railroad. Insurance was mentioned. The insurance that would be required in this bill is not adequate for several reasons. First, it wouldn't cover them. This says they would have a general liability insurance policy in place. General liability insurance policies do not cover anything within 50 feet of railroad property. They have to have railroad protective insurance, or else the insurance company will not cover them for any loss. Also, they need to have coverage for injury to railroad workers. Railroad workers are not covered by workers' comp programs. They're under a federal program called the Federal Employers Liability Act, a tort-based system. If there's a personal injury, both the railroad and the utility could be subject to responsibility for the person's injury, could be subject to litigation. They have to have insurance in place for FELA coverage when they work on our property. We have to have control over the design standards. Electric transmissions, as anybody who's talked on a cell phone or listened to the radio while going under an electric transmission line knows, they can cause interference. That has happened with railroad signals. There have been activations of grade crossing signals caused by improperly designed electronic transmission lines. We're in the process of installing a federally mandated system, positive train control, a new signal system which could be interfered with by these power lines if they're not properly designed. As I said, we have a deal in place. It has been effective. Apparently, if the railroads back off whenever the threat of going to commerce is waved around, then apparently the system that is in place is working. Let's see, comment was made about the ransom that we charge. As I said, our standard for utility crossing is $1,500. For an electric cooperative, it's $750. We don't believe that there is any need for this legislation. This is a matter that has been addressed in the past. A deal has been in place for 20 years. It has apparently been working. If there are specific problems regarding some of these companies involving BNSF, I'd be happy to talk to them. I can't speak for the entire industry. But reference was also made to legislation passed in other states. The South Dakota legislation worked so well that the parties that passed it are now trying to negotiate a master agreement with another railroad because they don't want to use the system that they just passed a year ago. So I would encourage the committee to vote against this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee? Senator Sparks.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate Mr. Sweeney's comments, and obviously maybe his railroad is different. I believe the reason that we brought the bill forward is what Mr. Johnson talked about back in Albert Lea when we had two similar crossings, and there's a difference of tens of thousands of dollars. Now, I'm not saying that $750 is maybe the magic number, but I think if we could bring some more uniformity to allow these companies to build and cross, certainly want to make sure that our railroads are safe and that they can map it and do all that. But when a similar crossing a few miles away is that much different, something's not working correctly.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the audience who wish to speak to this bill? Yeah, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks, has this been discussed before? Have we had this issue in front of us last year also? It seems to me there was an issue about this, or maybe. And the reason I ask Senator Sparks is you would think the railroad company could come to some agreement. And if you know that's truly the issue, the disparity on how much these crossings vary in their cost, you think they could step up to the plate and do this on their own without legislation? But perhaps I'm wrong.
Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, as it's been stated, we've had an agreement. The problem is it's not getting followed, and for a lot of my members, some of the smaller companies, you know, they have to hire attorneys and have to hire other things to do this process, so it's quite cumbersome. So we're just trying to get it set in law so that it can be followed by everybody and applied uniformly.
Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Then I move Senate File 877 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
I think it goes to the floor.
Thank you.
Is there any further discussion on the Rosen motion? Senator Osmond.
Senator Sparks, Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, what was said previously in testimony was that every time, or it seems like every time where these exorbitant fees come up and it goes, and the threat of going to commerce comes up, that basically the railroads back off. Is that between yourself and the testifiers, is that true that it happens 100% of the time?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmick, I don't know that I could say it happens 100% of the time. It's happened in several cases that I'm aware of. I'm also aware of several of my members that weren't aware of the agreement, so they get a bill from the railroads and they pay it. We're trying to educate them on that, but it's I would believe it's most of the time.
Mr. Chair, maybe to refine the question, has there been a time where an exorbitant or deemed exorbitant fee has gone to Commerce and they have upheld the fee? I guess I should ask it that way.
As far as I'm aware, there has only been one instance where a utility has actually filed a letter with the Department of Commerce, and that took place, I think, in the late 1990s. This summer, we reached this situation after back and forth with probably four different railroads. And each time, in most cases, we would have to, when we told them that we were and showed them a copy of the letter we were going to send Commerce, then they would back off. But again, it's a very time-consuming process for particularly the smaller co-ops, and who have work plans that really they need to start moving on some of these projects, particularly here in Minnesota, when you've got a fairly narrow window of opportunity to do the work that you need to do. The one of the more typical responses you'll get from the railroad is, well, if you need this within 3 months, then you have to pay an expediting fee, typically of around $2,000.
Further discussion on the Rosen motion that Senate File 877 be recommended to pass. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, Campgrounds. Senate File 681.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing Senate File 861. I also want to thank the other members, Senator Stump, Rood, Saxhog, and Rosen, who have expressed some concern with regards to this bill, and because they have campgrounds and resorts. And Mr. Chair, you and I had this discussion last year on the floor, on the fly, as they say, and you were kind enough to give me a hearing on this year. So that's what we're doing here, is we're bringing it forward. Please understand, we've been working with the MPCA on an amendment. Actually, they have two amendments. One that pertains to the actual bill itself. Another one is one that pertains to a licensure. The MPCA wants to put that on. I think you have both the A1, and I'm not sure what the number is on the second one.
I believe they have the A2 and the A3.
Okay. A2 and A3.
A2.
And A1 and A2, is that correct?
Okay. So should we deal with the A2 first?
Sure.
Senator Rosen moves the A2 amendment, the delete everything amendment to Senate File 681. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And the A2 is... A3 amendment is also to the A2 amendment that we just adopted. Okay, Senator Huffman moves, Senator Rosen moves the A3 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, this came to a constituent of mine sitting to my right, Mr. Cummings, who owns the Golden Eagle Campgrounds. About a year and a half ago, and probably even longer than that ago, the way time flies, as you all know. What he has for years owned and operated a resort on a lake near Pearl, Minnesota, which is in my district. And how this all came about, it's kind of a long story, but I'll shorten up as quick as I can. He went ahead and expanded in the campground business. And in doing so, working with the county land and resource folks, As we say, they crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's on the expansion, was operating, I think, in about 5 to 6 years. And then all of a sudden, somebody came along and offered actually to purchase the resort. The resort was going to be up for sale. Whatever happened, again, Mr. Cummings can add to what happened with he and the person on the sale, but what precipitated the action of the MPCA was that sale. It was then determined that he had not went along with the county. The county hadn't advised him to go along with the state permit, which was a lot more involved, and that precipitated the action here that we're trying to pass today, bringing forth the Senate File 681. So, in general, what it means is that. And I have with me Dan McElroy, who also represents the group of resorts and business places throughout the state of Minnesota. As you all know, we are really really struggling to keeping our resorts and campgrounds in the state of Minnesota. And I'm going to have Mr. Cummings talk about his history, and I think it'll all hit real close to home. Someplace in some family, we've been able to have a resort or go to a resort at one time, and those are good memories. And those things are fading away. And sometimes. We in government are very well intended, but sometimes get in the way of those expansions with some overbearing rules and regulations. And that's why we decided to talk with the MPCA. They've been forthcoming with the amendment and willing to work. But you just need to know it's not going to stop here. We're gonna meet with the MPCA in the summer with the folks, the resort and campground folks. We still have a little ways to go, some other clarity in statute. And I think before I go too far and get into too muddy a water here, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. McElroy and have him discuss with you what his role has been playing here, and you can ask Stan for some questions.
Mr. McElroy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Marty and members. For the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. We represent approximately 330 resort and campground owner-operators in the state. Ms. Senator Ingebretson said, we've been aware of the issue since shortly after an MPCA rule changed in 2011. Prior to 2011, the need for a state permit as opposed to county regulation, which has been the method by which the septic systems at most Minnesota businesses have been regulated, there was a rule change. Prior to that, the rule said, in essence, and Mr. Kodelka is behind me, he'll help me if I get this wrong, but essentially that a permit was triggered if either measured flow or a table in the rule, referred to as Table 1 or sometimes Table D, exceeded 10,000 gallons of daily flow during a 7-day peak period. In 2011, the rule changed to say whichever is greater, and that has caused a challenge because the measured flow in virtually every case we're aware of is less than the presumptive flow, which was intended as a design flow and not a regulatory flow. To make a kind of long story short, we had drafted a bill to exempt campgrounds from the SDS rules. The PCA is not supportive of that approach. We have worked with them for the last year to arrive at a compromise that would meet most of the needs, but not all the needs, of campground operators and resort operators in the state, while continuing to protect the environment. The essence of the compromise is to go back to measured flow and to put in this bill, or in the amendment, the A2 amendment, and authority for expedited rulemaking that would put these measurement provisions into the MPCA rule. And so that only if measured flow exceeded 10,000 gallon peak day during a 7-day period would the SDS permit be required, which was the case prior to 2011. I have members who would think a better solution would be to be exempt from SDS permitting altogether. But this amendment does put us in a position that solves most of the problem for most of the people. And we will continue. We have a commitment from the PCA to continue to discuss with us and the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association further clarifications that can perhaps leave. We don't believe the SDS system was ever intended for small businesses. It was intended for large industrial facilities like sugar beet processing plants and potato processing plants and for cities and towns. And that counties are a better place to regulate small business. We'll continue to have that discussion. We do support the amendment, Mr. Chair. We think it solves most of the problem for most of the people most of the time. And there are times when that's a good government outcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. McElroy. Senator Ingebrigtsen, you have other witnesses as well now?
I do. I have Mr. Cummings, Mike Cummings, to my right. If he could just give you a little explanation as to why he is so passionate about these changes and what is becoming of the resorts, at least through his eyes, to the committee.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cummings.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, what I want to address
Please identify yourself for the tape
Mr.
Cummings.
Michael Cummings. I own Golden Eagle Vacation Land in Perm, Minnesota. It's on Big Pine Lake. Okay, my wife and I started it about 33 years ago. We started out pretty slow. We just reinvested everything that we have, and now we have a very nice campground. We entertain a number of people. What I wanted to speak about today is not, I don't want to bore you with a bunch of figures. I want to talk about the other side of the coin. We always have logic, but then we also have emotion. And this is something that nobody has been talking about in the last 10 years that we've been kicking this can down the road. We want to get some legislation going. And one of the problems that we have is that when we go to logic, we're always talking numbers, and it seems like we always have a problem trying to distinguish which numbers are going to go ahead and set a standard for whatever. But looking at the emotion on this, we have in Minnesota, we've gone from 3,400 campgrounds down to just a little over 800 right now. That is pretty sad. Because this being the number one form of family entertainment in the state, it's a dying industry, and we need help. And the only way we're going to get that help is we're going to have to start getting some legislation that works to our interest. One of the things that we were able to enjoy as we were kids was being able to sit around by a campfire and you know, roast the wieners and hot dogs, have hot dogs and whatever, and the s'mores. And these memories stick with you. I imagine that just about everybody in here at one time or another has experienced this. And these memories stick with kids for a lifetime. But what we're doing today is we're taking these memories away from most kids. We are in the process of closing down campgrounds and resorts because of some regulations. Not only campgrounds and resorts, we're talking about Boy Scout camps, we're talking about Girl Scout camps, we're talking about church camps. And a lot of people are not even aware of what's happening out there. And I think that when they become aware, you're going to have so many constituents knocking on your doors and ringing your phone off that you're going to want to get out of the business. Because it's just very obvious that as we become smaller, the prices go up and less people are going to be able to afford to be able to do the things that we did. So that is the other side of the coin. And I'm hoping that this helps move us into some legislation to where we can get things started. And then we can work it together. I know we can put together a program that will work. Even if what I'd love to see is a preservation act for campgrounds and for resorts. But that can come down the road. But that's something we can work with. I guess that's about all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. What lake did you say you're on?
Big Pine Lake in Perm, Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? And Senator Ingebrigtsen, you have a couple other witnesses as well?
I do, if they'd like to come forward real quickly. I know you're busy, Mr. Chair. Maybe you'd like to say a few words. Sure.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Lang. I'm from the Family Recreation Coalition. Our goal is to represent those businesses and industries in the state of Minnesota that support tourism. I think that the testimony that Mr. Cummings gave in regards to the campgrounds something that is pretty much being overlooked. And I know that the legislature has had one little signal of the problem a couple of years ago when the numbers dipped down and the income generated by tourism in the state of Minnesota dropped by $30 million. Those numbers are available in the Minnesota Department of Revenue and also on Explore Minnesota's website and on our website. The fix for that problem was to give Explore Minnesota $5 million more than they get annually to go out and advertise campgrounds in the state of Minnesota. Meanwhile, we have campgrounds going out of business at a rate of 25 campgrounds a year. Our support of this bill is because it is the most significant force right now that is putting campgrounds out of business. There's a long and convoluted reason why we got to this point. And if you're reading that piece of paper and listening to us today wondering, what are these guys talking about, don't feel bad, because some of us have been at it for a year, and we're still trying to chase that rabbit hole down. But basically, this is the problem. Campgrounds have been complying with the MPC regulations, county regulations, complying with their contractors' requirements for their septic systems, the Department of Health for their water inspections. They've been doing everything right, everything the way it's supposed to be done. And this bill does not take not one single bit of that away. We're not asking to reduce the table. When we talk about table D, we're not asking to reduce that. That's a good number. We can design systems from now until whenever at 100 gallons. What we're asking for is that a campground not be put out of business because he's being required to prove that he's in compliance. Now keep in mind, his compliance was the permits he got in the first place. So even if you have all your records, if you can sing hymn, line, and verse, that does not mean that you are going to be immune from having to have a permit or having to have an advanced inspector. A permit costs $9,800 for a permit if they determine that you are in excess of 10,000 gallons. $9,800 for a permit to operate a campground in the state of Minnesota. After that, you have to get an advanced inspector. Without stepping on your campground, the going number is $400,000 for them to come out and look at your campground, which, by the way, has no problems, no violations, no septic running in the lake, no issues, nothing. But you're going to pay him $400,000 so that he can report back to the MPC and say, I went out there and looked. They're good. He might replace a baffle there. He may say, you need a couple more feet there. Minor, very minor changes to the existing system. But at the end of the day, that campground owner is probably going to pay about what his half of his gross for the year to just comply. And what this bill does is basically it says, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to let you measure your systems and tell us, are you over 10,000 gallons? Because if you're not, we're not going to bother you anymore. That's all it is.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I think that's the object of the whole thing, is to make those baby steps to some reason. And this, as Mike just explained, it does bring us at least that direction. And working with the MPCA, we can do things. And also, at all the time, being mindful of the environment. There's no question about it. These folks don't want to mess up their lake any more than anybody else. So
Thank you.
If you have any questions, I know you've got a very big agenda.
The PCA here as well, mm-hmm. if they wanted to comment briefly. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Adelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and thank you for the opportunity to talk on the amendment. And thank you for the work Senator Ingebrigtsen and other folks have you've heard from today, been working with us on the issue. I'll start with the 8-2 amendment, and this is something that we've been working with the Campground Association on. And this would be in a situation where if someone was referred to the state agency, MPCA, because either a county or we had to follow up on a complaint where there's a question of whether or not a state permit applies to the situation or not. The process here is if what would happen in those cases, we would use this process to determine whether or not the permit. The agency has no plans on using this process to go through and get a list of campgrounds and then go see, have everyone run through this. It would only be by referrals of those sorts to the state agencies. And the process that's set up here would be, at first we do the estimate as talked about. The table one would look at and see and determine whether or not it over 10,000 gallons per day. If it's not, it's clearly a county issue and we pass it on. But this sets up a process that allows for campground and resort owners to have 120 days to get a plan together to pull out together the data. What we didn't want to create is a situation where, well, you can give us the data, but if you don't have it, tough luck. We want to make sure we give a situation here where the campground owner has an opportunity to create a plan and collect that information before we ask them to apply for a permit and put down those additional dollars. And as mentioned previously, too, this is a good first step. It makes the changes to the 2011 change in rules. It reverses that and puts in a process that we can make those determinations. And during the interim, we're committed to have discussions with the septic professionals, the campground operators, and counties on some other ideas that are floating around also. Just real quick, Chair, E3, I thought I'd just explain it a little bit for the members. This is a issue that's septic related but not at all related to campgrounds, and just to highlight it a little bit, currently when a septic professional has 3 years and they need a number of continuing educations to keep their certifications or license valid, on their third year anniversary, if they don't complete that information, their license and certification lapses and they are no longer able to operate as an independent operator. They can work under someone else's guidance but not as an independent operator. They then have to follow their continuing education and also retake the exams before being able to work again independently. What we're creating here is a system that will allow for an individual to file for a year to work under a provisional license and then complete those two other items, complete their continuing education and their exam, and still be able to operate their business during that time so they don't lose the income. This allows for a little bit more leeway in certain circumstances where someone may not follow through with their continuing education, but still provides an incentive to do so because you don't have to take the exam. So it's a way we've worked with the University of Minnesota Advisory Committee on Septic Systems, along with the Septic Professionals and Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Operators Association to agreement to make the process a little better. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you for your time, and if there's any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer them.
Senator Osmick moves Senate File 681 as amended, be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government for rulemaking. Is there any discussion on that motion? Any further discussion on the bill? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, we will distribute. There are two bills of Senator Scalzi's that were on the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I know. Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. We're going to have Senator Hoffman bill up, but while he's preparing to come forward. Thanks, and thanks also to the DNR, to the PCA and Senator Ingebrigtsen for working together and coming together on this. Mr. McElroy, on this.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
While Senator Hoffman's coming up, Senator Scalzi has the last two bills on the agenda today. We weren't planning on doing them this time session, but it looks like we will be able to, and she's ready. So those will be handed out while Senator Hoffman is presenting Senate File 1534. And if we get through all that, we don't meet this later in the afternoon. Welcome to the committee, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Senate File 1534 is a conservation easement stewardship account establishment, and with me at the table is Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer, Also, Susan Damon, who is the Land Acquisition and Legal Services Manager of the Division of Lands and Minerals of the DNR, will be here as well. So thank you for the opportunity. Senate File 1534 creates a natural resources conservation easement stewardship account in the Special Revenue Fund. This will be managed by the State Board of Investment to maximize the long-term gain. DNR currently holds over 1,000 conservation easements. These easements require ongoing stewardship, including regular monitoring, to ensure that the conservation values remain protected. What that is DNR has an excess of over $1 million in existing Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriations for these conservation easement stewardship, but is not able to invest this money for a sustainable level of return. DNR needs to transfer this money into an account, which it will generate more interest and more savings. The goal of this initiative is to enable the DNR to monitor through the money earned in the account. And there's just two things, key all new DNR conservation easements and key easements where Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriations for stewardship have already been provided. With that brief overview, I'm going to turn the presentation over to the Assistant Commissioner Meyer and Ms. Damon.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. And for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. And I do want to note that this bill also establishes easement stewardship accounts for the Board of Water and Soil Resources in a similar fashion, and they are here to answer questions if need be. The overall premise is to establish an account that will be established within the state revenue system, be created a special revenue fund, and the State Board of Investment will manage the account to maximize long-term gain. So you can see the language here on 1.14 and down what those dollars will be, contributions to the account, money appropriated for specific purposes, and money appropriated for monitoring enforcement. The goal will be for this account to generate revenue, and then 5%, up to 5% of the revenue generated from that account will be annually appropriated to the department to the Board of Water and Soil Resources to do these monitoring and enforcement activities. So into the future, we will be seeking financial contributions into these programs, into these accounts, as we're establishing additional conservation easements. Mr. Chairman, member, we have spoke with other groups and organizations about this. This is similar to other types of accounts that are there generating revenue to provide revenue to do these issues or these management activities, and we'll be working with those entities into the future to seek appropriations into these accounts.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Ms. Damon, want to speak to the committee? Welcome. No need to answer questions.
She was my phone-a-friend, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there questions from the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, sub-D3, starting at line 2.6, financial contributions. I'm not quite understanding this. Who will the commissioner be seeking these? From whom will the commissioner be seeking these financial contributions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, as we go to the Outdoor Heritage Commission, the Sard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, General Fund, Game and Fish Fund, RIM Critical Habitat Programs, as we're acquiring these easements, depending on the type of easement, we will be searching or seeking funds from those dollars that are being appropriated to buy those easements. So, for example, a lot of these dollars, most of the funds out of this $1 million were appropriated to us out of Lassard Sams, about $750,000 for long-term monitoring and enforcement activities for the Blandin property, 43,000 plus acres up in forested area of the state. So they were kind of the forefront of this concept. Put some money into account to help provide for the perpetual. These are forever easements, right? So we need to make sure that they aren't being encroached upon. If they are encroached upon or built upon, that we have money to go after and solve that problem. This is only moving forward. The issue is much greater going backwards as we look at these wild and scenic river easements that were established along the St. Croix River. And we have many of these easements, and we don't have a financial mechanism to fund the ongoing activities there. So we'll be coming back and working within the budgetary processes to develop solutions to those monitoring needs as well. But this is, we will, to answer your question, we will seek these funds when we're trying to acquire easements with the different entities that are funding those options.
Are there questions from the committee? Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Meyer, it says here you're going to be going using up to 5% line 1.22. Do you envision a period where you may not need to use any and it would continue to accrue balance as opposed to having to spend the 5%? Or is there? Are you anticipating you have to spend 5% regardless of what activities need to be done?
Mr. Chairman, the 5% is a standard rate that we're actually trying to get our house in order, so to speak. We can talk about that issue in the Finance Committee as we get a little bit closer to that. We also need to do a little bit of work on appropriation language to clean up some of the appropriations that are actually in this bill. In the transfer section, I think there's some amendments that are needed as well that we'll work on in Senator Tomasoni's committee. But thank you for that question. We'll make sure that that's addressed. If we need to insert up to or something like that.
Mr. Meyer, since I'm not on finance and I wanted to follow up on Senator Osmick's question, is there a greater need right now because you have a backlog of conservation easement stuff that you're not, haven't been dealing with for lack of funding? Are you spending more right away and maybe less later on? I guess that relates to the 5% thing in there.
Mr. Chairman, that's some of the issue why it is 5% at this point in time.
Thank you. Are there further questions from the committee? Is there anybody who wanted to speak with concerns about the bill? If not, Senator Hoffman moves Senate File 1534. No amendments? 1534 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Two bills from Senator Scalzi, and we cancel the Senate File 1433 has been distributed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's helpful to get this done before this evening, so thank you for moving us forward. This bill, Senate File 1433, One Watershed, One Plan, streamlines soil and water management in Minnesota. And I think the handout that they've provided is very helpful. So if you look at this handout, you can see the timeline on the left side that shows how we got to where we are today. And since the passage of the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. And then if you look inside, you'll see a graphic of all of the watersheds in Minnesota. And then as we've been producing One Watershed, One Plan, these watersheds in blue have been pilot projects to get us on our way to furthering the plan. So what it does, it unites water planning group for three groups: counties, watershed districts, and soil and water conservation districts. And it's no new governance. It creates systematic, science-based, watershed-based management for soil and water resources in Minnesota. So it basically, we'll go from 200 plans that were produced to less than half. So, and we have here today with us Doug Thomas from the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Doug Thomas, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. As Senator Scalzi mentioned, the One Watershed, One Plan proposal is designed to unite water planning efforts of our counties, soil and water conservation, and watershed districts, primarily outside the metropolitan area. So this is really kind of geared towards greater Minnesota. Within the metropolitan area, it doesn't preclude participation, and there are some watersheds like the St. Croix, the Cannon, and the Rum, which are both in and outside the seven-county metro area. So the framework would accommodate those local governments to get together and develop a management and implementation plan under that framework. As Senator Scalzi pointed out, we are completing a successful pilot effort which provides the basis for this systematic transition to watershed management and implementation plans across the state by 2025, which is a goal that we have set. So what I'd like to do is just kind of walk you through the main points of the bill. The main purpose of the bill, which is in Section 3 starting on page 2, is to put the One Watershed, One Plan framework that Bowser has developed to create a comprehensive watershed management plan type into statute. The authority for Bowser to do this was done through legislation back in 2012 when the board was given the authority to develop guidelines, policies, and procedures for creating a comprehensive watershed management plan type. That's commonly referred to now as One Watershed, One Plan. The framework's been developed over the last 2 years with participation from the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and the Association of Watershed Districts, and is supported by those three organizations. It's also supported by the Clean Water Council, which adopted a resolution in March of 2014 supporting the One Watershed, One Plan framework. So within Section 3 of the bill, Subdivision 2 basically defines and articulates the purposes of the Comprehensive Watershed Management Plan. And again, it's to align the three current local water plans that are being prepared by our state soil and water districts, watershed districts, and counties under a voluntary watershed-based approach. It incorporates and makes use of current science and reports, including watershed restoration and protection strategies, RAPs, TMDLs, and other local studies. Its purposes to solicit and engage both citizens and stakeholder groups during the development of a implementation plan. And really, I think most importantly, have plans that are focused on implementation strategies that are both prioritized, targeted, and capable of demonstrating measurable results towards water quality outcomes on a watershed basis. Subdivision 3 defines the coordination role and responsibilities of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Subdivision 4 sets forth a list of planned content items that must be considered during development of a One Watershed, One Plan. Not that they're specifically required, but they must be considered during development is how that is structured. Subdivision 5 sets a requirement for Bowser to develop and adopt a transition plan by June of 2016 with the goal of completing that transition by 2025. And then lastly, within Section 3, Subdivision 6 provides language that assures that the completion and adoption of a One Watershed, One Plan does not replace or usurp any local authorities granted under Chapters 103B, which is the Local Water Management Planning Act, 103C, which is the Soil and Water Conservation District Act, and 103D. In other words, this isn't designed to create a new local governance or a new watershed authority. It's basically a way for each of those existing units of government to use their authorities to implement under the umbrella of a One Watershed, One Plan. The last sections of the bill, sections 1, 4, 6, on pages 1, 4, and 6, are really kind of technical amendments in that they're designed to add soil health to the state soil and water conservation policy, and that's in section 1 of the bill. Section 4 of the bill adds a definition of soil health, which is adapted from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's NRCS Field Office Technical Guide. And Section 6 of the bill recognizes the importance of soil health and the related activities of things like cover crops, conservation cropping systems, and improved nutrient management. It will allow soil and water conservation districts, with the approval from the Board of Water and Soil Resources, to cost share on non-structural land management practices that are part of planned erosion control and water quality improvements. Section 2 of the bill is to clarify and reinforce the board's authority regarding soil and water conservation practices. We've got a number of practices that currently are not in federally accepted or federally recognized conservation field office technical guides, things like rain gardens and some other kind of smaller urban practices. This would allow the board to work with a broad range of stakeholders to foster an understanding and provide recommendations for standardized specifications for those types of practices not found in that federal field office technical guide. And the last section, Section 5 of the bill, is to clarify and reinforce the board's authority to develop and implement a state-led technical training and certification program. We've done a number of work with our partner local governments with surveys, inventories, and a technical assistance summit in June of 2014. And basically, what we have found that there is a need to have a well-trained and highly qualified technical workforce if we're going to fully implement and achieve the objectives of Clean Water Funds, Outdoor Heritage Funds, and state programs. And this basically gives Bowser the ability to basically conduct and carry out a state-led training and certification program of our local staff. And with that, that completes my overview of the bill, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Scalzi and to Mr. Thomas, is it my understanding then what Bowser would be doing is creating a single plan where watershed districts at their convenience could opt in or opt out depending on their feeling or their thoughts as far as where the plan goes, and they always have the ability to opt out given their choice? Is that how I'm understanding this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmick, yes. It has a voluntary structure to develop these watershed-based implementation plans. We would expect that there will be an agreement going into it, and at any time, because, again, they're voluntary in nature, a local unit of government, including a watershed district, could decide to opt out of that agreement. And then basically, you know, the others could continue to operate together under that umbrella plan or not.
Further questions from the committee? Is there anybody else who wanted to speak to the bill? If not, Senator Scalzi, it's nice to see local government folks working together on the water.
Yes, Mr. Chair, anytime that we can streamline the process and require fewer reports, it's probably good for all of the groups, and they've worked from the bottom up, which I think is the main wonderful thing about this plan.
Thank you. Senator Osmick, did you say?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Scalzi, is it entirely possible as a result of this legislation that watershed districts will actually see a lower cost of doing business by having to not implement multiple plans across all kinds of different watersheds, or local jurisdictions by opting in could actually have a lower cost of doing business?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senators, I think that's exactly what the goal is going to be. As you know, watershed districts can tax. Soil and water conservation districts cannot. In counties, and Bowser generally fund the projects on the ground with the soil and water conservation districts. But it's the planning and the production of the plans that's going to be reduced from about 200 plans down to 60 because of this added work being done by Bowser. And I think it's going to be better for everyone, including the watershed districts. And they've all been working with this roundtable to get on board to get to this point. So it's been a number of years, and they've done good work to get here.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi moves Senate File 1433. It will be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there any further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you to you and Bowser and all the SWCDs and the watershed districts and everybody working on this.
Great work, thanks.
You have one more bill, Senate File 1754, and this is basically an appropriation bill, and we requested that people not come and say why they've got good appropriations in here. That's for the Finance Committee, but there is one section in here that is policy that you're bringing the bill here for. Section 10, I believe, Senator Scalzi?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment. This is the first stop for this bill.
Yes.
And that would put it back into the shape that it came from the Clean Water Council, their recommendations for funding and policy. And this is the first time, actually, that the bill has come from the Clean Water Council in the form of a bill. Prior to this, they really worked from a spreadsheet, and they went through the legacy subcommittee in the Senate there's a whole legacy committee in the House, so it's kind of a different process. But the main – oh, I, first of all, I should move the A2 amendment if you have that.
Senator Scalzi moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape she'd like to present. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
So basically – thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, the policy part starts on Section 10 on page 18. And with this with this amendment, we've deleted that section. There's been some questions of who should be voting members and who should not, and it came up in the other body, and I think that it deserves a little bit more discussion, possibly in the conference committee with the other body. So I thought at this point we would delete that section and leave that for further discussion in the conference committee. And then the policy starts on page 19. You can see the underline, for instance, where it says mercury contamination. Contamination is struck and other contaminants is added. And there's a sprinkling of policy changes as you go through the bill. On page 21, there's striking the word grants, 21.23. And inserting a grant program to help counties, et cetera.
Senator Scalzi, that is more, I'd argue that's basically finance.
Okay.
That's what you're using the money for.
Right.
So you don't need to. I actually think that Section 10 that you just took out of the bill was the one reason it was supposed to be here.
Okay.
So,
yeah, the rest is wording changes.
What?
The rest of it,
right,
the changes
those,
are wording
changes.
Those
are changes related to the appropriations, though,
okay.
And if members of the committee want to spend time on them, they're welcome to, but it's not technically the turf of the committee. So Senator Scalzi moves Senate File 1754 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there further discussion? Is there anybody in the audience who needed to speak to the things that aren't in the bill? If not, on Senator Scalzi's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And with that, committee members, we not only finished 5 minutes early, but we wiped out the late afternoon agenda as well, so we are adjourned until Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hallelujah.
Elections.